The title of my sermon is The Anatomy of Forgiveness. What is it? As you remember, last Sabbath, Pastor preached on the subject of conflict resolution. And today I would like to cover the subject on forgiveness. It is not secret for you that contemporary scientists, researchers, are telling us that forgiveness has a very positive outcome in the life of those who forgive. Is it true? Yes. Mental health outcomes such as reduced anxiety, reduced depression or major psychiatric disorders. It helps you improve your heart health, immune system, even lowering mortality rates. It keeps in check the societal relationship equilibrium. It's very important. And because of all of these benefits, the secular world is teaching us that we need to forgive. And it comes not necessarily from people who know God or believe in God. From secular world. More so for Christians, there is even a greater incentive to forgive. The Lord's Prayer teaches us that we ought to pray how? Forgive our sins or our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. There is an incentive to forgive. And that's sure, I believe you are praying for forgiveness and you are striving to forgive. But what is forgiveness? Here is a secular definition. Forgiveness is a conscious, deliberate decision to release feelings of resentment or vengeance toward a person or a group who has harmed you, regardless of whether they actually deserve your forgiveness. Forgiveness does not mean forgetting, nor does it mean condoning or excusing offenses. Is it a good definition? Do you like it? Well, it has some benefits to it, right? But as a Christian, I have a problem with this definition. And do you know what the problem is? It teaches you to manage your emotions instead of helping you to deal with a crisis. I understand that we ought to practice forgiveness, but as a Christian, I am not satisfied with this definition of forgiveness. Is there anything else to the concept of forgiveness? After all, how can we properly practice forgiveness if we do not even have a clear definition what forgiveness is? Today I would like to take some time to study with you what is forgiveness, and we are going to go back to the Bible, to the roots. So I invite you into the divine laboratory to look into the very anatomy of forgiveness. We will spend some time with Jesus in the book of Matthew chapter 18. So you can open that chapter, Matthew chapter 18, and tuck your finger between the pages, because we are going to stay there for a long time. Working with people in spiritual care, I discovered that just because a person uses the same words and phraseology does not mean that they have the same understanding of the word I do. So we need to clarify who is believing what. And it is true vice versa. While we use the same words, the meaning can differ. I'm discovering every time we are talking about forgiveness and a person is imagining totally different things than I do, right? You're talking about love and you have your love in your head and somebody has his love in his hand, in his head, and but you are talking about the same thing. How can you come to an agreement and find out what it is for you? Let us look briefly into the Greek and Hebrew concepts of forgiveness. I'll start with Greek concept. And by the way, as strange as it can be, I'm going to refer to the Bible, to the New Testament, because it was written in Greek language. At least we have it in Greek language. We don't have it in Hebraic language. So open with me your Bible, chapter 18, verse 21. And you have it on the screen as well. Then came Peter to him, to Jesus, and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Till seven times? Actually, that is not the right translation. Is it? Yeah, I'm sorry. Till seven times, and then the Lord will respond. Which I discovered a discrepancy. So we are not going to answer to the inquiry right now how many times you should be forgiven, because our purpose is to define first what forgiveness is. So let us see what Greek tells us about forgiveness. The Greek word aphēzo, that comes from the root word of aphēmi, is being translated as forgiveness or forgiven. And the literal translation or meaning of that word is to send, to let go, and to leave alone. You like these words? To send away, to let it go, and to leave alone. Does it sound like forgiveness? In the verse 12, feel free to open with me verse 12. We have the same very word, aphēmi, that Jesus is using in a very interesting way. How do you think if a man owns 100 sheep and one of them wanders away, will he leave aphēs, the 99 on the hills and go to look for the one that wanders off? The same very word, aphēs. Wouldn't he leave them alone? But the problem with Greek is that Greek culture never really developed a concept of forgiveness. To them, forgiveness is to take care of your basic emotional needs and care for your sanity. Therefore, you have to release all your grudges, all your frustrations, all your bad emotions, and manage your anger that you do not hurt yourself. So the basic concept in the Greek culture is let him go or leave him alone and let your resentments go. So if we are using this phraseology or this concept of Greek in Peter's conversation with Jesus, Peter is asking, Lord, how many times shall I leave my brother alone? Seven times? What does that really imply? It implies before I punish him, Before I take him to court, before I address him, how many times should I tolerate my brother? Right? 7 times? And Jesus is responding not 7 times, but 70 times 7. But you know, in our culture today, we are kind of using this concept of Greek philosophy or Greek forgiveness very widely, even in the church. I may choose to leave my brother alone, keeping not him accountable for what he is doing to me. Does it sound right? Do we do that? How many times do you address your brother or sister of their wrongdoings? Or I may choose to leave my brother alone, holding nothing against him. Okay? There is another way, which is widely used. I may choose to leave my brother alone by ignoring him and never talk to him again. Leave him alone. Is it forgiveness? No. That's not forgiveness. As you can see, there is not much change in contemporary secular definition of what forgiveness is, except of leaving your brother alone, choosing to let go of the negative emotions and the desire for vengeance for the absolutely selfish reasons. I'm not saying good or bad. You need to care for your emotions. But is that forgiveness? Leaving your brother alone and letting go of your emotions does not define what forgiveness is. Rather, it defines the choices you can make in finding peace of mind, making forgiveness a coping mechanism. And this is what you are invited to practice by secular world in a religious setting. A mindset of forgiveness as a coping mechanism. You know, in my studies, my attention was drawn to a Hebrew word. So let us talk about the Hebraic concept of forgiveness. And I'll ask you to open in advance with me your Bible in the book of Isaiah, chapter 53, verse 4. And keep your finger between the pages for a while. Are you there? Okay. So, the word for forgiveness in Hebraic mindset is nasa. Nasa. Which literally means to lift, to bear up, to take, to respect. Now let us read the text with these words in mind. Verse 4, chapter 53. Surely he took up our pain and bore nasa, and bore our suffering. The word forgiveness, nasa, is being used in an imaginary or imagery of one bearing the suffering of his transgressor. This is the ultimate level of compassion that is beyond comprehension. Forgiveness is being presented as the capacity to bear in your transgressor's suffering despite of your personal pains and losses. A radical difference between secular mindset of unforgiveness. Unlike the Greek and secular concept of forgiveness, teaching to leave your transgressor alone and focus on your personal, mental, and emotional wellness and happiness, The Hebraic concept teaches that the true satisfaction and happiness comes not from leaving people alone, but from working together towards an outcome that through the travails of your soul, you achieve a salvific outcome and a change in your brother who sinned against you. I would refer you to the text which proves that. Verse 11. He shall see of the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. So you have two things on your hands. You have a fake satisfaction, a fake happiness by letting people alone and letting your emotions go to be happy or obtain peace of mind. Or you are working with your brother and sister, with your transgressor, to a greater spiritual salvific outcome, and you receive satisfaction from the victory. Verse 12. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death, and was numbered with the transgressors. For he, again the word nasa, for he bore the sins of many, and made intercession for the transgressor. Very loaded text. Do you want to be great? I'm not talking great about look at me. I'm talking great in terms of your spiritual growth. Do you want to be strong in your spiritual growth? Then you have to bear the sins of your transgressors and become the intercessors for them. Isn't it what the text tells us? Conclusion. As you see, the Greek understanding of the forgiveness is reduced to a selfish action, namely, leave him alone, let it go for your own sake. While the forgiveness expressed in Hebraic word is rather a mindset, a character that would not give up on your brother, but rather would come alongside his brother to bear with him the suffering of his iniquity, to restore him to righteousness amidst your pain and loss. More so, forgiveness is taking the role of interceding for the transgressor, not leaving him alone, but contrary, working together on their relationship for a communal growth. It is like making a CPR to a spiritually dying person. When it comes to medical care, none of the doctors or nurses would stop doing CPR just because the recipient of CPR is a person transgressor. More so, we shouldn't be stopping to do spiritual CPR of forgiveness to a dying brother or sister in their own sins just because I am in pain. You know, the concept of forgiveness is best understood by observing it. And this is why Jesus is telling Peter the story. And I'm going to tell you the story, In response that Jesus told, in response to Peter's question, how many times should I forgive my brother or sister who trespasses against me? 7 times? And Jesus says, no, 70 times 7. So as the story goes, I'll read it line by line, and I'll allow myself to stop intermittently to make comments. Okay? Is it okay with you? Okay. So therefore, the story goes, therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. Well, let me make a note here. Do you notice that Jesus doesn't say that the forgiveness is like a king who wants to do something? He says the kingdom of heaven is like a king that wants to do something. It is very important distinction to make, because it tells you that the forgiveness is not a tool or a coping mechanism randomly used, but in the scheme of heavenly kingdom, it is the norm of heavenly reality. So Jesus is not talking about a coping mechanism. He talks about a character that is of heavenly nature. And therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. When we say the king wanted to settle accounts with his servants, I'm sorry. If you don't want me to steam here, catch on fire, I need to take that off. So what do you understand when it says that king wanted to settle accounts with his servants? Some people interpret it as like, pay me and that's it, right? Pay me what you owe to me. But setting the accounts involves at least 2 individuals, isn't it? If I owe you, probably you owe something to me, don't you? If I'm making relationship with you, probably we have something in common to discuss. So setting accounts is not pay me because you are my debtor, but it is, oh, let us sit down and see what I owe to you and what you owe to me. It is a dynamic relationship between the king and the servant. It means that regardless of their respective status or rank, whether being a king or a servant, they both are equally responsible to make all things right on the account. And by the way, the Greek word is very, very interesting in this setting. The Greek word synairo. Synairo. It is a complex word compound of 2 words. Syn stands for together. We are doing things together, like synagogue. Synago, together going. It becomes a synagogue, like snowball, right? Synairo. So I am working with you soon, together. Airo means raising up, elevating, lifting up. So the word synairo, basically what the king is saying, servant, I want to raise with you up through the experience of working together. It means that both the king and the servant are willing to be, first, transparent, second, opening the accounts for public viewing in order to ensure that the transaction is fair and justice is being made. Does it ring a bell to you? What kind of bell? To me, it sounds like it is a description of investigation action. Adventists believe in investigative judgment. Don't you think that the king is setting up a precedent to allow himself to be so open, so transparent with his servants for the public to look into their personal affairs and become their witnesses and become their spectators and become their jury duties? As this king began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. The investigation is going, and things are being discovered. And here is a person, a servant, who owes 10,000 talents of gold. For the sake of the story, we need to understand how much is that 10,000 talents of gold. Do you have any idea how much is that? Or royal talent, gold talent, is 60 kilogram, 600 gram per talent. So basically you have approximately 133 pounds in one talent of gold. If you would have one talent of gold, would you be happy? Well, this guy was not happy with one talent. He needed 1,000 talents. You multiply it and you have 606 metric tons of gold. If you want to compare it, the country of Netherlands have their golden reserves, 12.5 metric tons of gold. So basically, you just imagine this guy is embezzling the country's money. He's taking over the throne. If I'm going to get into your pocket and get your money, I got a hold of your throne. By now you understand that this servant is not a slave on the plantation. It is the CFO, Chief Financial Officer, in this man's kingdom. He compromised his integrity. He compromised his loyalty to the king. He embezzled an enormous portion of his economy. He became a threat to his master's throne. Since he was not able to pay, help me, what would you stick 606 tons of gold that you cannot get a hold of them to pay them back? Just imagine, you need probably around 120 semi-trucks to carry it from one place to another place. It is not something you can put it in the pocket and lose it in the dust of your pocket. And this guy doesn't have the money to pay it back, unless he ate it or pulverized it. But something happened. So the text tells us, Jesus tells the story that this guy didn't have the money. He did something. And because of that, his master ordered that he and his wife and his children shall be sold to repay the debt. That was verse 25. This is the highest point of tension in the story. All that the king wanted was fairness in interpersonal affairs. Pay me your bills, I will pay what I need to pay, and we are set. That is the ultimate justice. But because the servant couldn't pay his bill, the king appealed to retributive justice. I'm going to punish you. I'm going to sell you away to get my money back. He made an order to sell him, his wife and his children, to repay the debt. Along with the ideas of justice, can you imagine the brokenness and the pain this servant was faced with? In the matters of doing justice, we almost all the time overlook the pain behind of it. So our system of justice becomes insensitive to human suffering. More so, it is inflicting human suffering. The pain of realization that this servant is having, just imagine, totally failure for his future. His future is gone. His life is put to jeopardy. The life of his loved one is put to jeopardy. His children are put to jeopardy. Absolutely devastated. Would you like to be faced with such a situation where you have to compromise the life of your loved one and your own love for the sake of a pile of metal in your backyard? There is another painful realization. The compromise of his integrity reduced his value from a man entrusted to handle the riches of the country to a value of a slave to be sold of 30 silver coins. How much did he feel about himself? How much do you feel about yourself when you are a transgressor and you are being caught and you cannot pay your debt? We are talking about financial aspects of this. How about interpersonal relationships? Church, we are a church family. And here and there, I'm hearing gossips. How painful is when you realize that somebody just ruined your reputation by saying whatever about you. Painful stuff. This pain, the realization of his loss, this is what brings this man to his knees. Bible says that he fell on his knees and he started pleading. And he pleaded for what? For mercy. Verse 26. At this, the servant fell on his knees before him. Be patient with me, he begged, and I will pay back everything. The servant's master took pity on him. You know, I'm imagining this king. I'm just imagining him looking at his misery, looking at his realization that he is a mess now, that he is not that powerful CFO who was controlling all the dynamics, all the currents in this country. And now he is somebody who is nobody, sitting on his knees and pleading for mercy for his own life and for the life of his wife and his kids. I think he tore apart the heart of that king. Would you think so? And it says so. Jesus says, well, the king was so moved by compassion that he didn't grant him mercy. He granted him forgiveness. Mercy has a difference from forgiveness. We'll talk more about that. But until now, you can see that the servant was in the spotlight. All the focus was directed towards the servant, with him begging on his knees for mercy. The servant is shifting our attention from him to the attention on the king. Now the spectators are saying, wow, let's see what happens. Yeah, we know that he is guilty. Yeah, we know he embezzled money. Yeah, we know that he broke his integrity and trust. But what is the king going to do? Aren't you curious? I'm so curious. How is he going to respond to this? I want you to notice something. The servant did not ask for forgiveness. He asked for a merciful extension, making a promise to pay it back. And that is of a significant value. We'll come back to this concept. Just put it in your mind, and I'll move on, okay? Now, I have a question for you. Why is Jesus telling to Peter this story? You can see that in the very question Peter is asking, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me up to seven times? Peter is interested to how many times I can leave my brother alone before I call him to justice. We need to all I'm sorry. Because the concept of Peter, the justice in his mind, was far away from what Jesus is depicting here. And Jesus is trying to correct his understanding, to help him understand what forgiveness is. So let us pay attention to a few things. First, we need to do all it takes to keep things just. But delaying to making justice is not forgiveness. Let's make it clear. I see many people who are delaying in addressing his brother or sister's wrongdoing. And by delaying it, it is not doing justice and it is not doing forgiveness. The more you are allowing the sin to grow, the bigger it becomes and the stronger it becomes and harder it is to change things. So remember this. The more you are delaying in your process, seven times, the bigger sin grows. Look, it is easy to forgive when things have been reversed to their initial condition and or retributive justice is made. But what happens when neither is possible? So Jesus is placing Peter in a predicament. Peter, you want to forgive when you resolve your when you are ignoring your brother. That is impossible. You want to forgive by making things right. Pay me what you owe to me, I'll pay what I owe to you, and we are fine. That's fine. That's easy to forgive. If you return my stolen thing, I will have no problems against you, right? But what if things are at such an odds that justice or to make justice is absolutely impossible? What are you going to do then? Jesus is painting this story to help us see that in this incident, that justice is absolutely impossible, and that the forgiveness is above making justice. Bear with me. The debt of the servant is enormously greater than his capacity to pay back. Can he reverse things and make justice? No. The king's attempt to make justice by selling him and his family causes more injustice to his family. The king is stuck in a dilemma. Because you messed up, I need to sell your kids? That is injustice. How can a king of a universe or a country do that? That he is multiplying the injustice. And should the king do that, he would be joining the number of doers of injustice. It is a situation in which the king couldn't leave this wrong unaddressed, and yet it is impossible to address it without violating his personal integrity. You hear me? So now this king is in the spotlight, but he is in a dilemma. The guy cannot pay me, but to punish his family because of him, that is injustice. I'm going to multiply that injustice. How am I going to resolve the problem? Jesus is helping us to see that forgiveness is not a random act of kindness, but it is a virtue of a wholesome character that chooses to lift up a broken person who caused him enormous pain and loss without letting the gravity of the offense alter his character. The character of the king is answering Peter's question, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? And you know the answer Jesus said. I'm not saying 7 times, but 70 times 7. Well, 70 times 7 is a direct indication to the years God is bearing the suffering of his people as described in the book of Daniel. 70 weeks by 7. Right? He is carrying his people alone through, and he is not saying, leave you alone and I let my emotions go. He is coming alongside and carries them through. They are working with them through to help them nurture a mindset, a character of ability to forgive, because forgiveness is not something you learn by trade. Forgiveness is not something, a skill you acquire. Forgiveness is a character that you develop only by working with someone that knows how to forgive you. So Jesus is indicating to this time of jubilee for Israel people, that it comes the time when the Messiah comes. And when the Messiah comes, he is going to do what? To bear the sins of the world. Nasa. He is going to collaborate with you to help you grow from your wickedness into a righteous human being without being condemned, tossed around, ignored, and let go. By now it is clear that we cannot repay back for the choices Adam and Eve made. We cannot undo their transgressions. We cannot even undo our own wrongdoings. Neither do we have the capacity to pay off our salvation from sin. But Jesus forgave us. Jesus, you see, Jesus is stuck with us in our iniquity to help us get back in harmony with him. Forgiveness is nothing but restoration of the divine character in the fallen transgressor amidst the pain of your loss, even unto the death on the cross. How long have you suffered for your loved one to help him grow through his wickedness to a higher ground? That's forgiveness. In this story, the king is demonstrating that forgiveness is the highest level of the divine restorative justice. This king couldn't restore the justice by punishment, by retributive justice, but he is able to restore the justice back by restorative justice. I'm going to work with you, and hopefully you will become somebody new through our journey together. If you are listening carefully, Jesus is telling to Peter his own story. Lucifer, the chief officer of heavenly spiritual economy, embezzled the golden one-third of heavenly angels entrusted to him by God and corrupted them. He gossiped and dispersed distorted information about God to such a degree that restoring them back to God became impossible. The gold was there in his backyard, but it was so defiled that it was unable to be given back to God, because their minds were so poisoned about God, and the reputation of God in their mind couldn't be reconciled. Lucifer managed to run the ruin the reputation of God in the minds of his followers. He destroyed their trust in God, destroyed their integrity, and turned them into the enemies of God. He pilfered God's gold, once holy and loyal angels, and turned them into demons of dark. He despised life and planted death. With what could Lucifer possibly pay back to God for ruining the peace and harmony, breaking the trust, and causing loss to the throne? Did he have anything in his possession to repay back? And still, God forgave him. He did not want to sell Lucifer into eternal slavery to have his destiny sealed with the anger of eternal damnation. God did all that was in his power to restore Lucifer back. But Lucifer resisted, because he never believed in the forgiveness as a restorative process. He held on to his belief that restoration can be done by making justice and paying things back. And isn't it exactly the question Peter is asking? How many times should I let my brother go before I call him to court? So, Jesus is telling his personal story to Peter, putting in the context of human relationship. And the story ends, you know how. This servant is so happy about the outcome. He goes his way, and he finds someone, his fellow servant, whom he grabs, who owed him pennies, and he starts beating him, making him to give, to repay his debt. And here is now the duty of the juries, the spectators, the witnesses. They are watching this, and they are coming back to the king with a report. So, Because of that, the king is letting the wicked servant reap the consequences of his refusal to nurture within himself the virtue of divine qualities. The settling of the accounts in the spotlight is over. The conclusion is being initiated by the report of the spectators who became the witnesses who testified against the wickedness. And today, by the way, you became spectators as well. You're a part of the story. What did you see? What did you hear? Let us verify our records. The report on the servant. Let us see what is the report on the servant. Fact number one. The servant is the transgressor. He violated. He embezzled money. The servant cannot pay back what he owes. He is bankrupt, spiritually bankrupt. Second fact, the servant is not asking for forgiveness. He is asking for an extension to pay back. Because he doesn't believe in God's mercy. He believes in the power of money. The king granted him forgiveness. That is a fact. Fact number four. The servant did not forgive his fellow servant, but put him to prison. He didn't practice what he learned through the process of lifting up. God was so working hard to raise with, or the king, to raise with him up through the misery of his wickedness. And he didn't want to learn. Fact number five. The servant did not believe in forgiveness as the ultimate form of restoring justice. He held on to his idea that he can earn his freedom by his own doing. Well, let us see what is the report on the king. Fact number one. The king has proven that his mercy and loving kindness for his servant is greater than their transgressions and is readily to forgive his servants more than they even ask for. God's mercy is higher than your transgressions. Fact number two, the king had proven that his servants, their happiness and well-being are of higher value to him than his own loss. He lost one-third of angels. But the value of his creation was greater than his loss. He wanted to bring them back. The question is kind of, what is the priority of your values in your life? Your reputation or the life of your loved one or your enemy? Your money or someone who is dying in his sins? Fact number three, the king did not grant his servant any extension he asked for, but canceled his debt. Fact number four. The king has proven that he is just and anticipates nothing less from each of his servants that we do the same to other. He is just and he anticipates that you are as just as him. He is forgiven and he anticipates that you are going to learn forgiveness from him. Fact number five, the king proved that there is no such transgression or personal loss of such magnitude that would cause him to break his integrity or change his nature. It's heartbreaking to see how the pain our transgressory is giving us turns us into unforgiven, angry, hateful individuals. God is not like that. And he wants us to learn that from him. To what questions did the setting of the accounts answer? So we had a record of what is about this servant. We had a record what is about this king. Now, to what questions this setting of accounts answered? The wicked servant is not a king-made product. You remember how Jesus told some Pharisees, your father is devil because you are doing his works. Right? The king is saying, look, whatever you are doing, that's not me. I am held into my integrity and I'm treating you with justice, fairness, and with love and kindness against my own pains. I didn't create you. There is, by the way, a teaching in Christianity that Satan deliberately created God. Oh, pardon me. God deliberately created Satan. I need to drink some water. Losing my mind. Fact number two. The king remained truthful to his integrity. He did not change to deal with wicked wickedly. Fact number three, it became apparent that salvation of the servant was in servant's own hands. The king granted him forgiveness, but the servant has decided his destiny by not being willing to make it a virtue to himself, to be able to exercise it in his life towards others. He chose to remain unaffected by the virtue of king's forgiveness and thus sealed his destiny. So, the investigation is over. Juries told what they saw. What do we learn from this today? How relevant is it to me and you? Today I learned that forgiveness is when I choose to see a greater value in my brother than in my own personal pain and loss. Forgiveness is when instead of executing justice, you are doing all in your power to help restore him to integrity. I was once called to serve jury's duty downtown Portland. And while in that court room, people are coming and talking to you, trying to find out about how you reason, how you see justice. And he was asking, what is justice to you? How is our system just? And I said, our system is unjust because it creates more injustice than justice. And he was kind of like, wow, where you came from? And I said, because we are not helping people to grow in a healthier and better individuals, we are destroying them by punishing them. And he said, oh, okay. Never asked me a question, and then he didn't choose me to be the jury's duty. It is important that when we are doing justice, we are not focused on the fairness, but we are focused on transformation. Although fairness needs to be done, I'm not against it. It should be done. But that shouldn't obscure your sight from not seeing your brother that he needs to grow and be a better person. And you can help him or her. What else I learned? Forgiveness is when my brother is asking for mercy, but I'm declaring him free. In conclusion, friends, forgiveness is the virtue of God's character. The ability and willingness to forgive is the testimony of you being the child of God. And the Creator and the character of God is sealed in you when you are forgiven. You are acting the same how God is acting. Everyone who is cultivating the virtue, this virtue, would tie their fate with God and His kingdom forever. Those who are suppressing the ability to forgive are defeating in themselves the character of God, determining their own damnation, fulfilling the words of Christ. Truly, I tell you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And whatever you lose on earth will be loosened in heaven. And we see this man who loosened his ties from God to be in the prison. Should he tie his ties with God, reflecting his character, learning from him, he would seal his destiny with him. Because, listen, God doesn't have a problem to forgive you. His forgiveness is as real as God is. As oxygen is in this room and it is in your lungs right now, that is the forgiveness of God present. But the only thing can impede me from being forgiven is my inability to forgive. My choice to not learn to forgive, to resemble his character. That's so interesting that the beginning of this chapter starts with the disciples are coming to Jesus and are saying, who is the greatest in the kingdom of God? You know why they are asking the question? Because a chapter back, they saw Jesus on the mountain of transfiguration. They saw Jesus, they saw Moses, they saw Elijah, and now they are so confused with how can a loser like Moses can teach Jesus about his exodus? He didn't make it into promised land, and he came to teach Jesus how he needs to be successful. How come this